This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: anti-royalist activists turning to social media to call for the abolishment of the British monarchy. Tehran says Washington's latest sanctions show the U.S. is behind the false scenario accusing Iran of conducting cyber attacks in Albania. And the U.S. says that it has no hostile intents towards North Korea in reaction to Pyongyang's new law. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. 2 days have passed since the death of the longest reigning British monarch. Britons now think it is the right time to ask for Elizabeth II to be remembered as their last head of state. Hashtag abolish the monarchy is trending on various social media platforms. People think it does not make sense for another monarch to be elected in the 21st century. They also think the royal family is a political institution which lives off people's taxes and does not make any contributions to the society. Meanwhile, calls are growing in the former UK colonies in the Caribbean to remove the British monarch as their head of state. Some Commonwealth leaders have expressed doubt about what the role of the monarch is in today's time. Activists also argue that Charles's accession is an opportunity to redouble calls for slavery repatriations.
Britain has a new monarch. King Charles III used his first address to the nation since taking the throne to pay tribute to his late mother.
Queen Elizabeth was a life well lived, a promise with destiny kept, and she is mourned most deeply in her passing. That promise of lifelong service I renew to you all today.
Earlier, the new king, alongside Queen Consort Camilla, met well-wishers gathered outside Buckingham Palace, paying their respects after the passing of Queen Elizabeth II on Thursday. Gun salutes, floral tributes, and flags flying at half-mast symbolise the country in the first phase of an official 12-day mourning period. Messages of condolences flooded in from world leaders, with domestic tributes being led in the House of Commons by the new Prime Minister, Liz Truss.
Today, we show the world that we do not fear what lies ahead. We send our deepest sympathy to all members of the royal family. We pay tribute to our late Queen, and we offer loyal service to our new King.
These are unprecedented times, and the parliamentarians will be getting used to saying God save the king instead of God save the queen. But what will a monarchy under the stewardship of Charles III really look like? Charles's ascension to the throne comes following a 7-decade-long reign by the late monarch.
Lots of people who maybe were not great fans of the monarchy as an institution respected Queen Elizabeth II for her longevity, for her record. They forgot many of the things that she was also associated with, the end of empire, which was often very brutal in places like Kenya. But they gave her some respect, and you'll see that, I think, over the next 12 days. You'll see people prepared to give that respect to the Queen. I think it's going to be a very different story going down the road, and we should remember that the monarchy is very important to the British elite. The armed forces, the security services, judiciary, they swear loyalty not to Parliament, but to the monarchy.
Charles's new role as king comes at not just a tumultuous time for the throne, but for the country itself.
If he's going to be an effective king, he will have to speak to the nation in a way that brings people together. And that may involve him, and as Charles has known to do this in the past, be a very much more politically overtly political monarch than some of his predecessors. He's made interventions on various issues, and I think he'll continue to do that going forward.
At home and abroad, there'll be questions about what Britain's new monarch's vision will be. Will the tentacles of the new reign bring forth a new dawn? Former subjects across the world will simply wait and see. Amina Taylor, London.
Ukraine's president says the country's forces have retaken control of dozens of towns as they push a counteroffensive against Russian forces in the northeast. Zelensky's comments follow reports that fierce battles are underway in Kharkiv region. Moscow has not confirmed any advances by the Ukrainian forces, but it says it is sending in more reinforcements to the area. Intense fighting is also raging in the south, where a Ukrainian counteroffensive is making progress in the Russian-held Kherson region. Meanwhile, Ukrainian officials say 8 people have been killed and over a dozen injured in attacks on a town in the eastern Donbass region. Russia has denied targeting civilians. A new report on poverty in France has revealed the devastating economic effects caused by European sanctions on Russia over the Ukraine war. Multiple indicators have reached record lows, showing that their lower classes are worse off than they ever were in decades. Ramin Mazahedi has more.
The annual report from one of France's top NGOs revealed that poverty has already skyrocketed this year. And that's at what many say is only the beginning of years of inflation and recession provoked by sanctions on Russia over the unrest in Ukraine. Secours Populaire found that the number of people who say they have known poverty has increased 9% in just the past year. That's the biggest increase in 30 years. This year, over 40% of France says they can't pay their transport, medical, energy, or childcare bills, or go on vacation, or even buy fruits and vegetables. It's the highest percentage they've ever recorded.
The poverty question in France is one that's been central, but the social safety net is running out. It's just going to get worse and worse for the poor people, because they're not going to be able to afford this stuff, you know? And the French are not going to be able to subsidize these cost of living increases the way they did.
The steep increase in poverty comes after a decade of failed austerity policies and a deep devaluing of the euro currency. The government just announced they expect the next 2 economic quarters to produce a growth rate of 0.2%, and then 0%. Many predict that the essentially recession-level economy will soon begin massive layoffs. That combination spells stagflation, and it's something for which liberal economics has no theoretical remedy. This adds to the feeling of unease, especially among the investor class and high finance.
France has a pretty good record of having a social safety net for those who are on bottom as far as health care is concerned and other basic necessities. But since Macron got elected, a lot of those things have changed because Macron has decided that he's going to attack that social safety net.
The report showed that a near universal 85% of France is worried for the future generations. That's also the highest percentage ever recorded. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Moving on, Iran has roundly condemned the United States' imposition of sanctions against the Iranian Ministry of Intelligence and its minister. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nassar Kanani said Washington's new bans, unlike its previous illegal sanctions, will not be able to sap Iranian authorities' will to serve the nation. He said the United States' support for Albania's baseless accusations against Iran is a clear proof that the White House itself was behind the whole scenario and that Tirana had fallen victim to Washington's move. Tehran's reaction came after Washington imposed sanctions on Iran's intelligence minister over alleged cyber attacks against Albania, which is a U.S. ally. Iran has dismissed the charges, saying that the Islamic Republic itself has been a victim of cyber attacks. Relations between Iran and Albania have been tense since the Balkan nation provided a safe haven for the anti-Iran terrorist group MKO. To discuss that further, we're joined by Sayed Mustafa Khoshchashm, political analyst from Tehran. Sir, please help us understand this sudden flare-up of diplomatic tensions between Iran and Albania. What are the underlying causes?
Hello, and thanks for having me. Well, the Albanian government is corrupt enough to be ruled by the United States. There is no denial of that. They've been hosting a terrorist group, thousands of them in Camp Ashraf in Albania and outside, who've been running software attacks, fake news media, as well as cyber attacks on Iranian facilities for quite a long time. And pictures and videos coming out from the hall shows that hundreds of them and maybe 1,000 of them are sitting behind their laptops and running campaign against the Islamic Republic, which is not just fake news, but also it's cyber attacks. But the terrorist group, MKO, Mujahideen Khalq Organization, the hypocrites, MEK, PMOI, PMI, NCR, NCRI, no matter what they are called, they change names like the Al-Qaeda in Syria to clean up their records. It doesn't matter because they've killed 17,000 Iranian civilians and officials in the past several decades, including a prime minister, a president, a judiciary chief, a prosecutor general, as well as 72 MPs and 17,000 other civilians, and they have so much blood on their hands. And then they assisted Saddam Hussein in the war against Iran. And then when their expiry date came to its end, then the United States moved them to Camp Liberty from Diyala in Iraq's Erbil, northern Iraq, to Camp Liberty in Baghdad to protect them and find them a new house. And when they realized that there is no one foolish enough in the whole world to risk its own security for the sake of a terrorist group, they removed the terrorism label, I mean the United States itself, Hillary Clinton, and then the UK and the EU followed suit, and then they used the corrupt nature of the Albanian government to find a house for them. And ever since then, they've been running terrorist attacks on Iran, as well as the cyber attacks and many other, the fake news campaign against Iran in Persian and English. And they've never been doing anything, just blaming Iran. But let's remember that that there are editor-in-chiefs, journalists of Albania and Albanian origin that are on the run for the sake and because of this terrorist group, and because they are afraid of him, because they are carrying guns in and outside the camp in violation of the terms of the agreement that they have with the Irana corrupt government. But forget about Albania. The United States has been, pursuing this line of policy. They should remember that they have been, launching cyber attacks on Iranian facilities in the last at least 13, 14 years, that started with Doko, son of Doko, then Stuxnet. Stuxnet, they need to remember what they have already acknowledged. It pushed the world from an era of cybersecurity environment to cyber warfare. They could have caused havoc in Iran, radioactive pollution, and they know that, and they have acknowledged that in that documentary of theirs calling the Olympic Games or the zero day, whatever they call it. So if there is anyone to blame, it's the United States that has been, they've been running some kind of campaign against Iran in the past spring. They happily said that they have launched cyber attacks on Iranian airports, Iranian Tehran municipality, many other plans, that they have been happy to, cheer their attacks against Iran. So even U.S. administration officials have acknowledged that when they launch cyber attacks, they have allowed the whole world, not just Iran, the Russians, Chinese, North Koreans, and many others, they have sanctioned this kind of attacks, but it's not Iran. Actually, it seems that the U.S. is getting prepared for a new round of cyber attacks, and they're trying to find some kind of alibi for that.
Thank you very much. That was Sayed Mostafa Khoshchashm, political analyst, joining us live from Tehran. Now, North Korea is facing criticism from several countries, as well as the United Nations, for declaring itself a nuclear weapons state. The UN chief has expressed deep concern over the North's new law enshrining the right to use preemptive nuclear strikes. Antonio Guterres has urged Pyongyang to resume talks to achieve sustainable peace. France has also condemned the law as a threat to international and regional peace and security. Paris says North Korea's aggressive declaration effectively eliminates the possibility of denuclearization talks. However, the U.S. has reacted cautiously, saying it has no hostile intent towards the North and continues to seek diplomacy. North Korea has officially enshrined the right to use nuclear weapons to protect itself. The North Korean leader has described the new law as irreversible. The country is already under international sanctions over its nuclear and missile programs. Political analyst Shindo Hu says that North Korea feels threatened by the U.S. military presence in South Korea, and that is the reason why Pyongyang says it reserves the right to defend itself in case of a potential attack or invasion.
So when the United States talk about a threat from North Korea, people in the West often ignore the fact that North Korea feels threatened by the United States, by the presence of U.S. military forces in the soil of South Korea, remember. And also sometimes the U.S. will fly in, for example, B-52. That's a lethal force, obviously, I would say, a real threat to the sovereignty and the security of North Korea. So both sides feel the threat from each other. They need to sit down and talk about their security issue and then move forward of building a normal country-to-country relationship. But so far, what we have seen is, you know, in Seoul, there's a new government which has given up the previous practice of engaging North Korea or sanction policy in the sense that is more engagement with North Korea, and so they can build a peaceful and stable relationship or stability in the Korean Peninsula.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. After the attacks by the extremist and far-right supporters of the former U.S. President Donald Trump on Capitol Hill on 6th of January 2021 and their attempt to change election results in favor of their party and to prevent the approval of current President Joe Biden, what was perceived to be democracy in America is now seriously being questioned and criticized. Recently, American politicians are trying to portray each other as a threat to democracy. For example, President Joe Biden recently, in a speech in Philadelphia, said, "Democracy and equality in America are facing threats, and we must protect our values. The threats to democracy in America are real." We have prepared for you a selection of press and media articles on this issue. Please stay with us. NBC News website writes, President Joe Biden accused former U.S. President Donald Trump and his supporters of promoting an extreme ideology that threatens democracy in a rare primetime remarks on Thursday, 1st of September, as he stepped up attacks on conservatives ahead of next November's midterm elections. President Biden said in a speech from the Independence National Historical Park in Philadelphia, he said, "Too much of what's happening in our country today is not normal. Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans represent extremism that threatens the very foundations of our republic." He accused so-called MAGA Republicans, a reference to Donald Trump's Make America Great Again slogan, of refusing to recognize free and fair elections, increasingly talking about violence in response to actions they don't like, and of being determined to thwart the will of the American people. President Biden said, "MAGA Republicans have made their choice. They embrace anger. They thrive on chaos. They live not in the light of truth, but in the shadow of lies." Biden claimed, "Not every Republican embraces their extreme ideology. I know because I've been able to work with these mainstream Republicans. But there's no question that the Republican Party today is dominated, driven, and intimidated by Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans, and that is a real threat to this country." President Biden laid into those who have embraced Trump's false claim that the 2020 presidential election was rigged and sought to disrupt the coming 2022 midterm elections, calling the belief a threat to the fundamentals of American democracy. Explaining more about this issue, VanityFair.com website reported, "In his first rally in the wake of the 8th of August Mar-a-Lago search, former U.S. President Donald Trump lambasted current President Joe Biden, the Justice Department, and Lieutenant Governor of Pennsylvania, John Fetterman. On Saturday night, 3rd of September, in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, Donald Trump called the President of the United States an enemy of the state. This fiery accusation was likely fueled by comments Biden made in a speech on Thursday, 1st of September. Biden said, "Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans represent an extremism that threatens the very foundations of our republic and democracy." Trump further described Biden's speech on Thursday at Independence Hall as the most vicious, hateful, and divisive speech ever delivered by an American president. Addressing the FBI search of his Florida home at Mar-a-Lago, Trump called the Justice Department vicious monsters who executed a shameful raid and break-in of my home in Mar-a-Lago. He also called the search one of the most shocking abuses of power by any administration in American history. Saturday night's incendiary rally echoed Trump's presence on his social media platform, Truth Social, recently. According to the New York Times, he posted 88 times in a 24-hour period, including calling Biden's health into question after the president gave his speech on Thursday. If you look at the words and meaning of the awkward and angry Biden speech tonight, he threatened American democracy, including with the possible use of military force. He must be insane or suffering from late-stage dementia. His comments come as speculation intensifies about Trump announcing his intentions to run for president in 2024, ahead of the 2022 midterm elections. But Donald Trump's political ambitions could be derailed by a series of criminal and civil litigations against him, including the legal jeopardy he faces after being caught in possession of sensitive government documents at his home at Mar-a-Lago in Florida. Newsweek also reported on the same issue from a different angle. U.S. Senator Patty Murray has said that democracy is at risk in the United States and defended a controversial speech that President Joe Biden made recently. He said on Sunday, 4th of September, during an interview with CNN, that supporters of former President Donald Trump were willing to use brute force to halt the peaceful transition of power on 6th of January 2021, when thousands of people marched against the certification of the 2020 election, which placed Biden in office as the current president. Patty Murray said, "I believe that our democracy is at risk today. I was in the nation's capital on 6th of January 2021. I wasn't able to escape. I was barricaded in an office. And I heard the pounding at the door, and I heard those who were outside of it willing to use brute force incited by President Trump to take over our country, to take over our democracy, to stop the transition to a new presidency in a peaceful way, which is what democracy is all about." She said, "We have to get back to a point where we all say that brute force and incitement of that brute force, and a question that the president and his followers continue to put out there about whether or not that election was legitimate, incites that." She added, "And we will have people today saying there will be violence on the streets. That is not what democracy is all about. And we all have to point that out and work to make sure we move towards democracy and keep that democracy." On 6th of January 2021, Trump supporters occupied the U.S. Capitol while lawmakers were in the process of reviewing the certification of state electors, which indicated Biden's victory. Some Trump supporters had hoped that this process could have resulted in some of the electors being disqualified, thus overturning the outcome of the presidential election. It is claimed by some that the demonstrators were infiltrated and incited by provocateurs from U.S. intelligence agencies who orchestrated the false flag operation in order to get rid of Donald Trump. Some among the crowd clashed with police officers and some made threats to beat up a number of Democratic lawmakers. Some also inflicted damage on parts of the Capitol building. Joe Biden, in his speech on Thursday, condemned Donald Trump, saying that the former president and his supporters are determined to take this country backward. Biden said, "Backward to an America where there is no right to choose, no right to privacy, no right to contraception, and no right to marry who you love." Trump has claimed that the January 6, 2021 protest represented the greatest movement in the history of our country. He said in June, "January 6 was not simply a protest, it represented the greatest movement in the history of our country to make America great again."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The UK is marking the death of its longest reigning monarch.
Queen Elizabeth II, who reigned for more than 70 years as Britain's monarch, has died at the age of 96, with her son Charles now succeeding her as king. In a statement, the Buckingham Palace has announced 10 days of mourning. The death of the British Queen has revived criticism of the monarchy system, as well as UK's legacy of colonialism. In this edition of The Spotlight, we'll discuss the position of the royal family in British politics and also delve into the legacy the British Queen has left behind. The guests we have for tonight's show are political analyst Shabir Razvi, joining us from the British capital, London. And we also have journalist, author, and activist Fra Hughes, joining us from Belfast.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Razvi in London. What was the Queen's role in British politics? And in general, what is the monarch's role and the royal family's role in British politics? Is it strictly ceremonial, or is it a key role in the discussions and the direction of the country?
Hello, good evening. Of course, we are told that it's the constitutional monarchy here, and the Queen and whoever... Now Charles would become a ceremonial head of state. But the reality is somewhat different. Queen is the head of the state. Queen is head of the church. Queen appoints the Archbishop of Canterbury. Queen gives direction to the government, not in the legislative sense, but certainly very clearly she has an influence of what happens in politics here. And secondly, the Queen, for the last 24 hours and even a little bit earlier, there's been a whole sort of remorse, how wonderful the Queen was, how much good she did for Britain. Yeah, she may have, but she lived a life of a leisurely lady. The commentators, the royal correspondents in UK have been reporting that she had a busy schedule. She used to work, and service of the nation. When you're rich and wealthy, and the ordinary people in UK at this moment are finding it difficult even to keep warm, then it's very easy to sort of forget that she came from a very privileged background. Her ancestors and her herself, having been a monarch, as you pointed out, for the last 70 years, presided over the diminishing British Empire, but at the same time was able to instigate all kinds of crimes under her watch. One may recall that in 1952, when she was her coronation took place, a year later, there was a coup d'etat in Iran in 1953. In the early 60s, there was a massacre of Mau Mau sort of independent fighters, of nearly 500,000 in Kenya. There's a whole litany of crimes that have been committed under her watch. Sometimes people are saying here, oh, she was an old lady of 96 years old. She was a grandmother, a great grandmother. It's not the time to talk about these things. I ask the question, when is the right time to talk about the legacy, the sort of blood-stained legacy of the British Empire, and it continues even though there is not much of an empire left. But the interference, the murder, the killings that have taken place on this planet from the east to the west. So really, I think it's quite extraordinary. And the way it was nicely put by a Carnegie Mellon professor, Uju Anya, just before Queen was dead, 24 hours prior to it. And she said, I heard the chief monarch of a thieving, raping, genocidal empire is finally dying. May her pain be excruciating. And then she continues a day later, if anyone expects me to express anything but disdain for the monarch who supervised the government that sponsored the genocide that massacred and displaced half of her family, and the consequences of which those living alive today are still trying to overcome,
right,
you can keep wishing upon a star. So the reality is that there are many people on this planet who have experienced the atrocities committed by her government. It is said that she there were 15
okay.
prime ministers of this country under her monarchy, and each of those prime ministers was really part of the atrocities, as I said earlier, committed all over the world.
Let's bring in Mr. Frahughes into the discussion. Mr. Hughes, let's talk about the Queen's legacy. Now, she had her admirers, there's no doubt about that, but to many, she stands as a representation of an institution of colonialism, imperialism, invasions, displacements, exploitations, and wars, as mentioned by our guest in London. One example was the Australian Indigenous senator calling the Queen a colonizer while being sworn in at Parliament. Walk us through both sides of those viewpoints, if you will.
Okay, well, firstly, if we take the side of the monarch and the royalists, what we could say is that this lady presided 70 years as the head of state. She was someone that intergenerational groups of people could look up to, from grandparents to parents to grandchildren, that there was a continuity throughout those 70 years. While 15 prime ministers may have come and gone, the Queen was there as a steadying influence on British society. It could be claimed that she was there for guidance. Every Christmas Day, she is in the homes of tens of millions of British people who watch her as she reads out her government's speech for the forthcoming year, their policies for the next 12 months. You could also say that she was a moral compass for the country, and that she kind of encapsulated the values of loyalty and service and dedication. That would be values that would very much be seen to be British. So that's probably the story we hear about this, you know, perfectly genteel old lady who just tried her best to serve the nation as best she could. Now, if we look at the other side of the coin, the monarchy is, Queen Elizabeth II was a continuation of everyone before her. Now, I'm Irish, I live in Ireland. I can go back to Queen Victoria and the famines in Ireland of 1847 to 1852. Over a million people died and a million people emigrated. So we had a man-made famine in our country when there was enough food to feed the Irish people, which was taken out of the country and sold for profit. The Choctaw Indians raised money as another oppressed people and sent that money to help in famine relief in Ireland. And the Sultan of Turkey sent three ships to Ireland bringing food and aid and succor and solidarity to the people of Ireland, and Queen Victoria had those ships turned away and refused to allow the aid to come to the people on the island of Ireland. So her legacy is one, a prime example of how the monarchy and British imperialism go hand in glove, would be the recent knighthood that was given to Tony Blair. Tony Blair joined the Privy Council, a very small elite group of people that are given access to and give advice to the Queen. He is seen by many to be a war criminal who's responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people in Iraq and millions of people who were made refugees. So The British monarch rewarded a potential war criminal with the Knight of the Garter and invited him to become one of her closest advisors. And this is how the monarchy and the imperialist establishment of Britain continues to work together to exploit what's left of the Commonwealth to further destabilize sovereign nations like Syria, like the NATO attack on Libya, like the bombing of Yemen. And this latest proxy war through Ukraine against Russia
right.
is part of their task to balkanize Russia.
Jimmy Rezvi, the new British Prime Minister Liz Truss is seen in a video from back in 1994 where she is saying the idea of the monarchy is quote-unquote disgraceful. Is that a view shared by many in Britain, and that word disgraceful, is it because the monarchy is in a way a representation of elitism and racism?
Well, I'll come to the topic of elitism and racism in a minute, but I think it's interesting to note that Liz Truss, her first name is Elizabeth, and our queen is also known as Elizabeth. Liz Truss met her 24 hours before she died. So on the humorous side, if you like, maybe Liz Truss, when she spoke at the conference of the Liberal Democrats when she was 18, saying that the monarchy is an outdated sort of form of administration, perhaps she was thinking when she was meeting the Queen was that, you know, this room ain't big enough for two Elizabeths. And within 24 hours, one Elizabeth is gone. So that's an interesting way of sort of looking at the wishful thinking of Liz Truss came through. But on the other hand, if you like, there is, of course, the whole idea of the British monarchy has been sold to the public here in such a incredibly wonderful way that people in sort of at the economic level have no sort of relationship with the manner in which the royals live and the ordinary people, but nonetheless they seem to support it because the PR, the marketing, the illusion that is created that how good the monarchy is as our sort of guest from Northern Ireland was talking about. So what happens that even the minority communities living in UK, whether they're of Indian, Pakistani, or other Commonwealth countries' background, they've been lining up outside Buckingham Palace, expressing their remorse at the demise of Queen Elizabeth. Perhaps a lot of the former colonies' immigrants who are living in UK, they may be suffering from some kind of Stockholm syndrome that they don't realize that the pain that has been given to their ancestors, but at the same time, they're sort of in support of the Queen Elizabeth and the monarchy. And the sad pity is that some of the Muslim organizations in the UK and their leaders have been posting condolences on their websites in London and tweeting in support of the monarchy. So there is, as I said, this aura which has been created through the PR machine to portray the Queen as an upright, moral individual who was in service of her nation. Yes, may have been in service of her nation, but at the same time was part of the administration, part of her government, which was really incredibly,
okay.
Created atrocities all over the world.
Frau Hughes, calls are growing louder in former colonies, for example, in the Caribbean, to remove the British monarch as their head of state. Some Commonwealth leaders have expressed unease about the passage of leadership from Elizabeth to Charles. Why do these countries still have to swear an oath to an unelected monarch when there's proper doubts about the role of a distant monarch in the world we live in today in the 21st century?
Yes, I think there's merely be two sides to this particular question to maybe focus on and to answer. The first one would be, I cannot understand. I know the people of Ireland fought nearly every generation to remove the military occupation of our country from British imperialism. That fight still goes on today, mainly politically, but there are people who still believe that people who are illegally occupying our country, that being the British imperialist forces, should be forced to leave and Ireland should become a sovereign nation. So there's no sovereign nation and there are no oppressed people in the world who were ever given their freedom by imperialists or monarchs who suddenly woke up one morning and said, do you know what, we have no moral, legal right to be in this country, so we're going to leave. So they have either been thrown out from the previous colonies through armed insurrection and national wars of liberation, or they have somehow been able to move on to a more political footing where they have continued their membership of the Commonwealth. Now, once upon a time, the Commonwealth might have been viewed as an economic bloc, the former constituent parts of the British Empire, which traded together. So there would have been trade between Britain and Australia, Britain and Canada, Britain and New Zealand, Britain and America, Britain and South Africa. Choose whichever one of the countries in the World War 22 that the British have colonized and militarily occupied. So I believe very strongly that people who were oppressed and colonized by British imperialism should break every connection with Britain. They should stand strong and stand up for themselves. And with the League of Nations throughout the world, they should stand tall and independent. And as you've said, in the modern world, as we move towards a multipolar world, Britain will have less and less influence in what is happening on the geopolitical kind of chessboard that is the world today. And I think previous Commonwealth countries should all become independent and all should have president-elect and their own parliaments and not have to swear fealty to a foreign oppressor in a different land halfway around the world.
Sure. Shabir Rezvi, let's talk about the royal scandals. Meghan Markle's accusations of racism behind the walls of Buckingham Palace. As we know, a former UK official has been quoted as saying the royal family members regularly indulge in routine racism. That's one of the scandals. Prince Andrew, the Queen's son, and the Jeffrey Epstein scandal. Let's not forget about the death of Princess Diana, which, by account of many conspiracy theories, was pegged on the royal family itself. Has the royal family managed to hover above the law?
Well, certainly it looks very clear. The Queen rescued her son by paying, if I recall correctly, £15 million as hush-hush money in the Epstein sort of scandal when he was going to be prosecuted or potentially prosecuted in the USA. So, you know, rich mother helps her son to escape the full weight of the law. Yes, of course, the whole issue of Diana, and then multiple other scandals that have been part of the royal family. And this is where the interesting question arises. When the press here are saying that, you know, she brought some kind of morality and ethics to society, but really her family, her children were involved in all kinds of scandals. And not only that, you may recall that Prince Charles, now King Charles, was supposed to have taken £2 million from the Bin Laden family as a donation to one of his charities. And we don't know how many other kind of scandalous donations that were received by Prince Charles's charities in his previous life only as a prince. So there's a whole host of scandals. So it's very clear that the full weight of law is never applied to the royal family. Ordinary people may have to go to prison if they are involved in any sort of sexual peccadilloes or taking money from terrorist organizations. But the reality is that the royal family can get away with it because, as I said earlier, the whole weight of press and the media and the PR machine comes in, which tries to portray the royal family, the Queen particularly, as some kind of symbol of morality and ethics. And that's where the congruence, the contradiction occurs, whereby one cannot really understand how the general public does not rebel in this British Isles against the royal family and become a republic itself.
Frau Hughes, King Charles has been a polarizing figure with his fair share of scandals, as Mr. Esvey just mentioned, over the years. What are some of the challenges that he faces now, and what do you think will change for the UK and for the royal family with Charles wearing the crown now?
Firstly, I'd say some of the challenges he's going to face are, firstly, his age. He's already in his 70s, and while the Queen might have had several decades to build a rapport with the British people, he's not going to have that. He's sometimes seen as quasi-eccentric, a bit of a kind of bumbling prat. For him to become the next head of the Church of England and become the next monarch, I think he'll struggle with his public persona. I don't think he has the same personality. I don't think he has the same warmth that people may have imagined that the Queen had. I think that people will view him very much in the context and in the shadow of the death or murder of Princess Diana in Paris. There are theories that she was pregnant with Dodi Fayed's child, and that might have been part of the reason why someone might have not wanted her to continue with the pregnancy and live. And the fact that he may well have been having an extramarital affair for many, many, many years with Camilla Parker Bowles while he was actually still married to Princess Diana. So I think he's going to struggle in the role. And I think within the next 20 years, we will see a breakup of the United Kingdom. So you will see Ireland reunified. You will see Scotland independent and possibly Wales. So you will have Charles as King of England and nothing else, and a diminishing Commonwealth. And I believe that there is a growing call that Britain should become a republic, and that this kind of anachronistic, old-fashioned monarchy, which many people believe is dripping with blood, it's maybe time to move on.
All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Thanks to political analyst Shebby Rezvi joining us from the British capital, London, and thanks to journalist, author, and activist Frau Hughes speaking to us from Belfast, and, of course, a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. Bye, everybody.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means...
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from...
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decreed.
His decree, though, we learn...
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah. So, dear listeners, we are talking about ubudiyyah, the worship, servitude, and obedience to Almighty Allah. Now, when it comes to ubudiyyah, one of the things that we must be careful of is not only to be able to control ourselves, but also to gauge our pulse. Now, this might not make complete sense at this point, but once we are done in the program, it will make much more sense. Now, when we're talking about gauging our own pulse, we are talking about kind of making sure to know where we are on this spiritual progress. Now, of course, you know, when we are in this spiritual wayfaring, this journey towards our Lord, this journey towards Allah, which of course is known as Ubudiyya, we have to be very careful that the spiritual wayfarer or the salik, or in our terminology, the person who's doing the Ubudiyya, doesn't break the reins that are placed around the self. So what does this mean? Well, this means to push yourself so hard that you break yourself. And this doesn't mean a philosophical breaking of the self where the self comes under your control. Rather, this means the actual breaking of the self where you can no longer pray anymore. Or in more precise terms, what happens is that you don't want to pray, you don't want to fast, you don't want to conduct the different worships and the different servitude and the different obedience of Allah, because you have put so much pressure before it could handle it. And so the spiritual wayfarer, when it comes to controlling the self and when it comes to the amount of pressure that is put on the self in order to do the different prayers and different obedience of Allah, this spiritual wayfarer needs to be like a clever physician. They have to gauge their own pulse during this progress on this journey of Ubudiyya. Is there being put too much pressure? Is there not enough pressure? Are there certain things that must be focused more upon, certain things to be focused less upon? The wajibats must be done, the muharramat, the things that are prohibited, must be refrained from. And so they have to gauge and balance so that the individual, so that the self is able to continuously progress on this spiritual journey of Ubudiyya, and so that one can treat their self according to the requirements at the certain point and stage and time of their spiritual journey, their Ubudiyya to Allah.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Salim Yusuf Ali.
In one of the letters that he writes to Sheikh Mufid, he tells us one of the ways that we can end the ghiba and make his reappearance come faster. What does he say? He says that if only our Shias would come together with united hearts, number one. Number two, in order to fulfill